This is a Pinball News production.
Good afternoon. Thank you all very much. I appreciate your coming to listen to me. I appreciate being at your show. I was here a couple years ago, and it's a pleasure to be back again. What a lot of games down there. It's really exciting. It really is for me. You know, we all have the same interest. We're interested in pinball. You all are collectors, enthusiasts, players. We have it as a business, but we're enthusiasts. We're enthusiasts in both your way and our way. You know, all of us that work with me, and now Steve again and Lyman again, we're doing this as a business to make a living, but also, you know, it's our avocation. It's what we do. I've certainly done this all my life. My father bought into Williams when I was 2, and I started working there in the stock room when I was 16 in the summers. So I've been around this for a long, long time, and I certainly am interested not only in it as a business, but in pinball continuing. And so we all have a common interest in pinball. But we don't do everything the same as we did it all the years ago. There's change. We need to have change, which is what I want to explain to you a little bit about what we're doing. I know it's the Albert Einstein definition of insanity, that if you continue to do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result, that's insanity. Well, we are trying some different things. Some of you have heard me talk about this before. Some of them are going to work. Some of them aren't. Some of them you will think are nuts. Some of them you'll think make sense. But at least I'm going to have an opportunity at events like this to explain to you all what we're doing, why we're doing it. And then you may think we're nuts, but not crazy. One of the things that we've done, and I've told some of you before, is that I took on a partner, Dave Peterson. It's a venture capitalist type of guy, but also interested in what we're doing, interested in a special product like this. I'm 65 years old. I want pinball to continue, and the company is not going to go away with me. One day I'm not going to do this, so I have to provide for its continuation, for its future. And, oh, hi, Steve. I didn't see you sitting down there. Take notes, remind me what I missed, and so forth. Any event, so we have a plan for succession, a plan for continuing the company and to better it and do things differently than we've been done before, some things the same. You know, we basically have been doing the same thing since I started in this business, since my father started in this business in 1947 as a manufacturer. You know, he started originally as a game operator in Philadelphia, Sam did. And some of you heard me tell this before, so I'm going to tell it again anyways, because some of you haven't. He became a game operator, and then like many game operators, he to get games at a better price, sooner than his competitors, what have you, he became a game distributor. And in 1947, as a punk kid, I can say, you know, 35 years old, I can say he was a punk kid, because I'm 65 now, he came in to see another punk kid named Harry Williams. He was about 39 probably at the time. So Sam sat behind Harry's desk, kidding around, put his legs up, feet up on Harry's desk and said, "Why don't you sell me the company?" Harry said, "Well, I have to think about this. I'll go up in my airplane." He flew around Chicago for 3 hours, came down and sold my father half of Williams. So that's how the family got into pinball manufacturing. I was 2. When I was 3, the whole family moved to Chicago, and I've been there ever since, and most of that time making pinball machines ever since. The guys that we brought in, Dave Peterson and his guys, are more than just investors. They're helping us. They're helping us change our structures to be not just an entrepreneurial one-man-owns company, but more systems, more organization, a little less that I get to do or have to do, a little more for everybody else. They're marketing people. They're production people. One of the guys that came with them is Al Dale. You saw his picture, and those of you who came to see Steve's presentation, he was the project manager at Chrysler for the Jeep Liberty, so he understands getting products started and on the line. We've looked at our production, done some reorganization of it. You know, you have to remember that we are, first and foremost, a manufacturer. Yes, we design games, but we're a manufacturer. We have to manufacture games every day. We have people to, again, as Steve pointed out, we have people to pay every day. It's not we're going to design a game and then we're going to make it and then we're going to go design another game. Every day we're designing games, we're making games, we're collecting money to pay for the parts, to design the games, to make the games, and so forth. It's a complete manufacturing business, full-time job of doing everything. There are people doing everything. There's a full structure of people doing everything. We're looking at how to better that structure. But a pinball machine is a complex thing to make. It's got 32 man-hours of labor, more than the Ford Taurus that used to be manufactured not far from our factory. It's got 3,500 pieces, different parts in it. We have a bill of material that's very, very thick and very structured. We have an MRP system, a material requirements and planning system. All these things are part of manufacturing that we have to have and operate. So, you know, we want to design great games. We want to have the best games for the different people in the market. And yet we have to be a manufacturer. And as Steve says, we have to make a little money. Now, we survived the Lehman Brothers recession, as we call it, a couple years ago. And you all know that we downsized at that time. And we have since started to rebuild our company, both with, you know, a little more structure and so forth, and with more people. Steve, again, Lyman's joining us starting on Monday. So, you know, we're going to keep working on these games and make more and better games for the marketplace, which we're going to talk about what that is. We also have to consider the servicing of the games. We have many of you have talked to Chaz and to Pat. I think we have an excellent service department. Dorothy does a great job with parts. That's probably the most important part of our business, having that service department in place, understanding the product. They're with an 800 number ready to help you all. They're very experienced, and as a matter of fact, you know, you guys know that many of you, guys and ladies, mostly guys, know that many of you buy games from all over the country. And when you have a problem with that game, the person who sold it to you in South Carolina or wherever, and you're out in Wyoming, he's not there to help you. Our guys service games and get them serviced and help you get them serviced all over the country. We help the guy in South Carolina who sold it to you. Pat and Chaz do an excellent job of taking care of y'all. I hope y'all appreciate it. When you talk to them on the phone, please say thank you to them because they are great and they are hardworking guys. As I said, you know, it's a complex product, and we are now, you know, restructuring the company. We are adding the people that we need to make more games. We're going to do four new models a year in various configurations, and we need to talk a little bit about what that market is. We certainly think you are an important part of it, both as collectors and the tournaments. It, sort of as an aside, I'll tell you that we've done a lot of coordination with the IFPA, with the Sharps. We appreciate the tournament systems and the ranking they're doing. We've participated in various ways at various of their sanctioned events, tournaments. We started having our introduction parties at for the different games, our premier introduction parties, which we usually have a tournament at. I was just in Italy at the trade show, and our distributor there has a tournament which includes the Italian champion, was the world champion last year, Danielle. He didn't win this year at the European Pinball Championships in Normandy, where I was last weekend. We think that the tournament function is very important, and I want to keep that in mind and come back to that in the end of my presentation. With this opportunity and talking to you, I want to talk a little bit about what we see as the market, what we're trying to do. Steve mentioned a little about different levels or segments of games. And, I'm going to use some words that may sound like business school or something, but some segmentation, different channels that you sell through, and not very business school sounding, but not one size fits all. We have three legs to our stool, sort of like milking a cow. The farmer has three legs. And no, we're not farmers, and no, we're not business school here, but we do have these three legs. And That's the three different customers that we have, the three different segments that we need to make products for, and understand that those segments may need a different product. We have a lot of operators that still use our games, and we need more of them to use our games. We need to service the operator market. Those operators need to make money. They need to have a return on investment in our product. They need to have a game that people want to play and is fun. So we've looked at our design concept, and we are reviewing our design concept. We're changing the design concept. I'm going to say that my opinion is that if we don't have game operators operating games, if we lose all of the games on the street, then not in my business career, but at the end of your collecting career, pinball won't be interesting. Pinball won't be collectible. There won't be pinballs anymore. You know, people collect cars because cars are current and they want the old cars. You know, they collect things that are current, that have something to do with today's life, that are still being produced. So new collectibles are made today that will be collected in 20 years. How many McMansions with four-car garages have you gone by, and when the garage door is open, each of those garages had four horse and buggies in them? Nobody's collecting horse and buggies. They're collecting cars, and they're collecting pinball machines because pinball machines do exist. They're part of the culture. They're part of Americana. Certainly, if we didn't have pinball machines, the world would continue to exist, but a little bit of the fabric of life would be gone. And your hobby, I believe, would ultimately be gone if we don't have game operators. So one market, one segment that we have to deal with is game operators. And we have, you know, half of our business is export, half of it is domestic. Peter Betty, one of our largest distributors, our largest U.S. distributors, is back there. He's selling mostly to game operators at Betson. Very important part of our market. We have to have all three of our legs. In our export market, it's mostly game operators. And if we lose that volume of business, we don't have enough business. In Southern Europe, it's almost all game operators. Very little games are sold to private individuals. In Italy, in Spain, what have you. In Northern Europe, there are more individuals than in Southern Europe, but a larger percentage of the games are sold to private individuals. But still, the game operator is the important part of that business. In Australia, it's probably half and half. So we need to service the game operator. The second leg of our stool, the second leg in our market, is people like yourselves, the enthusiasts, the players, the great players, the collectors, and we have to give you a game that's interesting for you, has enough in it for you, and that you find to be, the type of product that you want to have. The third segment is just general homeowners. It's doctors and lawyers with too much money, so they're going to buy a pinball machine. Not too much money. I hope they keep buying those pinball machines. But, you know, it's doctors, lawyers, or other people who want something in their house. It's a pinball game to play. It's cool. It might be something they played younger. They're probably 45 years old, and they probably are male and told mommy it was for the kids. Because mommy approves every large ticket purchase in the house. You guys may be a little different. Some of you may be able to get past mommy and just say, I'm buying a pinball machine. But most of us, if we want a 52-inch TV, mommy better think that it fits in the family room and that she wants it. So, you know, the pinball is cool to these guys. They want to have fun with it, and we need to make a game that they have fun with. But we know that, you know, it's a game. It's also furniture, art, an American icon for them. You know, you watch one of the shows I can watch with my 23-year-old is Cribs, where you see the rock stars' houses and all that. And usually they do three houses in a half-hour show. And at least one of them has a pinball machine in their house that he's as proud of as he is his Ferrari. I tried to trade a pinball machine for a Ferrari. Hasn't worked. But I'm still at it. If any of you have a spare Ferrari, I have a spare pinball. But again, we need all three of these segments. And if we don't keep all three of them, then we don't have enough business. And if we don't keep all three of them, the business will die out, and then the collectability will die out. Now, going back to segments and not one size fits all. All these people, all these segments, all these players, yourselves, the operators, players in the pubs, in the bars, in the French cafes. The homeowner must have one thing, get one thing from the game. They got to have fun. So we got to give them a game that's fun for everybody. But that's not the same for everybody. Not everybody wants the same thing. What we found, we looked around, and my English distributor sent us a Gottlieb Spinner card. We have a playroom across from my office to play games with. I'll take some 8x10 glossies of that. And the guys will play games in there. And we had where Lyman, who's a great player, and one of our other programmers, who's a great player, would play every afternoon. I don't know why they weren't programming, but they were playing pinball. But they were programming because the games were 90% skill. Our more recent games, until recently, were 90% skill, 10% chance, randomness. The ball is wild, as Harry Williams would say. But the ball wasn't wild. It was all controlled. So one guy would play, Lyman would play while the other guy was in his office programming. As he walked by, you're up. The other guy would play, and he'd program. They were never in the same room at the same time, and the game would be 45 minutes, an hour and a half, go on and on and on. We brought in this Gottlieb game from the 60s, I think it was, our customer trying to prove a point to us, and they'd both be in there. And in fact, by the way, I could occasionally get a ball when I played that would beat them because, as Harry Williams said, the ball is wild. These games were half skill, half random. Okay, percentage here and there. Steve's going to argue with me about the exact percentage, but it's a metaphor, if you would. It's about half and half. That was our first argument recently. So, any event, if you go down and look at some of these older games downstairs, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. And, you know, we go to these tournaments, you go to the tournaments, and you'll have a tournament in somebody's house, and four people will be playing, and the game goes on and on and on. It's too much skill, not enough chance. The ball is wild, Harry said, and we lost the ball is wild. So we're coming back to that in our game design philosophy. We need the operator to make money. When these games were 90% skill, the great player played for 45 minutes on half a buck, 75 cents, didn't need to play again. I played for 45 seconds on half a buck, didn't want to play again, wasn't fun. The game could make a dollar an hour, half of which went to the bar, half went to the operator, and at 50 cents an hour, he's not going to buy a $5,000 pinball machine. It just doesn't work. We need to make the games fun for people, and we need to make them timely. And that's what we've been doing with our game design philosophy, starting with Buck Hunter and on to Iron Man and Avatar and Rolling Stones and the next game, which is to be mentioned later. But not later tonight, today. Please appreciate that that's what we're trying to do. If we want young people to play pinball, if we want pinball to exist, we got to have, you know, some 25-year-olds in a bar have a good time playing it. They're not going to have a good time if it's 90% skill. They've got to, the game's got to play itself a little bit. Let the pop bumpers, you know, ball gets up in the pop bumpers. I'm going to wipe the sweat off my hands while it plays for a little while. And then go back to playing it. Let the game play itself a little bit. Give them something. Give them a chance to beat the other guy. Little randomness. You know, they want to play for a couple beers? Fine. It shouldn't be one guy gets all the beers and the other guy pays for all the beers. So that's what we're trying to do in our game design. Please understand that. We're shortening the time. We're making them a little more random. We're letting the casual player have a chance at the game. Now, once again, that's an overall design concept. But different segments, different desires. So we have taken the games and said we're going to make different levels of product with different contents in them. Now, as we do that, there's a lot of engineering changes, improvements, both cost, reliability, and production-wise that we're working on. But again, we're just coming out of the Lehman Brothers recession. Going to take us a little while to get all the things that I dream of doing done. Then there's some other people have some dreams of things to do. But the segments, we need to do a little something different for. Again, collector, operator, general buyer, and ultimately, really, a homeowner game, which I'll get back to last. You take our current games, you take Avatar, we made a pro version. We added some things, some eye candy, and some mechanical devices, some rule, to make it into a little bit more of a game. Numbered it, one of 250, two of 250, to make it more collectible, and to add value to it. And by the way, they sold from us whoosh like that. People wanted them, we probably should have made more of them. But the idea is that the premium that we added these things to, the pro for the regular operator, the premium for you guys or collectors, will be more expensive, but have more things in it. And we're just feeling out what that would be, and that'll be changing over time as we develop more, do more engineering, and figure out how much eye candy and how much devices to put on it. You know, right now we chrome them, we mirror them, and so forth and so on. We are shortly going to be starting to make number one of 350, never 351, of Rolling Stones limited edition, which will have chrome, mirrored back glass, the lit bottom arch, I'm not going to remember everything, a couple of magnets in it, the white ball that's sensed for double scoring. It'll have what we call the English skill posts. In England, to get around the Gaming Act, we needed to show that the game was more skillful. So, below this flipper button and this flipper button, there's two more flipper buttons, one on either side. When you hit the left flipper button, a post comes up momentarily, left out lane. You hit the right tip so you can prevent the ball from draining, if you're very skillful. Again, this is not the game operator's game. The right flipper button, post comes up on the right side. Hit both, post comes up between the two flippers. So it's a skill feature. They don't come up and stay up. They come up momentarily. There's other things in the game that just slipped my mind right now. Different artwork on the back box, things like that. So there's more mechanical stuff in it. There's another song in it. Rolling Stones has 13 songs. Rolling Stones Premium has 14 songs, all performed by the Rolling Stones. So a little bit more, a little bit different in it. So again, different product, different segment. Operator and general homeowner. Most of the games you guys are going to buy because of the price point, new or used, will be the pro, a more full game at a higher price, collectible, numbered, with more bells and whistles and more eye candy, the premium. You know that we also made another version called the Classic, which was a non-coin-up version of Iron Man. And the idea is to get into more people's homes. Wasn't cheap enough, really, to get to where we wanted to go. We're experimenting. As I said before, we're going to try some things. Some will work, some won't work. That one didn't quite work as well as we wanted, but we learned a lot from it. For those of you who've seen the Iron Man Classic, maybe a page out of your book, but all of the control lamps are LEDs, and Lonnie has done a fantastic job of the light show on them, and the thing's just gorgeous, and it's modern looking. Now we've got to figure out how economically to do LEDs everywhere on the game, not just the control lamps, but also the GIs. And you say, oh, it's easy, do it like they do it downstairs here. Yeah, but that's, you know, $100 a game or something like that. It's past the price point. We have budgets we have to deal with, and we have to stay within those budgets, as even Steve says he recognizes. So we're looking at how we can do this economically and have it work. But, you know, you go and you look to Las Vegas and look at a slot machine, there's no light bulbs. They're all LEDs. You look at the taillights in a car today, they're LEDs. You know, everything is changing. Light bulbs are going, and that's what we're going to ultimately have to do. But as I said, the Classic didn't get us exactly where we wanted to get. It was a good experiment. We sold some, got a couple more to sell if any of you are interested. They're pretty cool. They're a lot of game for the money, but they're not what we really want to do. We want to get way down in price and still have a real game, not a Zizzle game, though they're very nice people. Roger Schiffman, the boss there, is a friend of ours. And they did a very neat thing, and they sold a lot of those, and it was a good introductory-level thing. But we need an entry-level game that is still a real pinball machine, near real or real size, and just simpler, maybe back to some of the old games. You know, some people say to me, and some of you have said this, that we should go make some of the old Stern Electronics pinball machines, the Stingrays and what have you, you know. It's hard to go make something and have it be the same thing as it was then. But having said that, you know, we need to find a game for this entry level so we can introduce more and more people to our game, to pinball. We talked about channels. I mentioned channels. We have different segments, so therefore we need different channels to sell them in. Right now we sell game operators through distributors like Betson. I have to be careful because he's here, and I'm going to talk about other channels. We sell games to you all through some of your dealers, some of the dealers down here who may get them from us or may get them from a distributor. We've been selling some billiard stores to get to homeowners. Different channels for the different segments, different customers. You know that we sold some games, and this is where we want to end up with our entry-level type game through Costco and through Amazon.com, what have you. And those are our games. They buy and stock games, and we're thrilled with that. It's just another way to get pinballs out there. So we're studying, we're trying to figure, we're changing all the channels that we're dealing with for the different segments with the different products. We're changing the product. One size doesn't fit all. We're changing the design philosophy. We're changing the product. Different product for different segments. We're changing and adding to the channels so that we can service the entire market of interested people that could be interested in pinball. Still, the key here is everybody's got to have fun. It means you have to have fun. It means the players in these different categories have to have fun. The operator has to have fun collecting all the money that's in the game. Steve has to have fun designing them, and I have to have fun, or I should just go snowboard and not even do this. So I'm having fun as long as you guys help me have fun. Now, what can you do to help me have fun? When I was here two years ago, I said pretty much the same thing, and I'm going to say it again. You all have your tournaments, your leagues, your things often at home because you don't find enough games out there to play. We're working right now in New York with some operators and with Steve Epstein, who's the original Broadway Arcade and the original Papa, and the IFPA to do some leagues there as an experiment. We need to get games on the street, as I said. We need operators using games, or this whole thing will disappear. Now, some of you won't agree with that. I'll say that again. I firmly believe if we don't have games and coin-op, pinball machines will ultimately be gone. If a group of you, go to a bar and say, we'll put seats in your stools, we'll have our league here every Tuesday night or every other Tuesday night. If you get your operator to put a pinball machine in here, or two pinball machines in here, that's a lot for one location. He may listen to you because you represent business, those seats in a stool. The league, the money out of the pinball machine is great. The beer money is better. If the operator won't put the game in, sometimes the operator will let you put the game in. Our carton designer, Domboski, he operates games over in Berwyn near our factory, and that's exactly what he does. And he's got nice games. And by the way, they're kept up well because they're his games. And he rotates different of his games there. So, again, out of the basement, as I say, and I don't mean that to be insulting, it's just a phrase, but, you know, get out. Yes, and pinball is a social game. It's social when you guys all play in your house. It's social when you play in the bar. Okay, the beer may cost a little bit more. Not a lot, you know. And, you know, it's a different atmosphere. That's where it's supposed to be. That's where pinball, that's where coin-op games are supposed to be. Get you know, put seats in the stools, get the bar owner to put games in, work with the IFPA, do your leagues, put your own game in maybe if they won't let you, if the operator won't do it. I said one third thing, you know, besides, you know, go to the bar and put your own game in if you have to. The third thing, which started here, was somebody should have a website listing games and where they are. And, of course, we got a call from one of you all with Pinball Rebel telling us, you know, oh, I've got that site. So we linked to that. Now we have, you know, this kind of information with his and other information on our website. And please, when you, you know, look at our website. If you travel, find somewhere to play games. If you, in your own area, post your own games on there. So that people, you know, games, not your own games, games and locations near you, so that people can see what the community is and see where games are. I know we would have a magazine come to us in Chicago, you know, and say, we want to do an article. Where do we find pinball machines? You know, we had a hard time for a while. Now we can find pinball machines in Chicago. We'd have to call the operators and so forth and so on, you know, call Betson and ask them who they sold a pinball to, and find some games for them in Chicago. We, you know, Jody Dankberg joined us. He does our Facebook page. He handles our PR agency. And you probably noticed a lot more articles recently about pinball. And you know, that's what we're trying to do, is increase the awareness. Well, one of the ways to increase the awareness is to tell people where the pinballs are. So we're changing our design philosophy. We're making games for different segments. We're dealing with different channels. We understand one size doesn't fit all. We want to make the games that you want and that other people need and want. And we want you to help us by getting out there and playing games in coin-op environments. Now, I love to be here. I'm very happy to be with you all. And let me answer whatever questions I can and do the best I can with it.
Just to mention the websites, what about the operators, getting them to partner with you or the websites to tell us where the machines are at instead of having Easter eggs every bar in town?
Good question. Two points to it. Number one is it's sort of a chicken and egg. We need to get the operators more interested by showing them that we're more interested. Not me, you, are more interested in those games out there. So which comes first? Goodbye. So which comes first? Get them more interested, then we'll get that. The other fear, though, the other problem is a lot of operators don't want to tell you where their games are, don't want to publish where their games are. They want to tell you. They don't want me to tell another operator to go steal that location. That's the history of game operating. So, you know, there's the two problems are we got to get them interested enough to do it, which means the games have to make more money, the change in design concept, no more 45-minute games, and we have to deal with the fact that they're afraid of losing their good locations. Great thought, not yet. I'll get you.
Why didn't you use the clips from the movie on Batman Dark Knight?
Why didn't we? In the Dot Matrix, you mean?
In the Dot Matrix, similar to what you did with Iron Man and Spider-Man.
Sometimes they're available, sometimes they're not. I can't remember that particular instance. Not all the time are we allowed to do that. You know, there's a big problem. No, not a big problem. Let me do this another way. We are licensing a title, and we're licensing certain aspects of it. Often we want the music, or we got to go somewhere else. If we license film, do we have to pay SAG? Do we have to pay the actor? Do we have to pay the writer? You know, once in a while you can do it. Once in a while the movie company has all the rights. Modern movie today? I'm not so sure. It depends. I've got one that I have bought for us all of the rights. I always try to buy the rights for digitizing into the Dot Matrix, but it's not clear. It's a gray area. If pinball was, when you all here make pinball more successful so that it's really out in those bars and in arcades and what have you, then I'll have to deal with what to do with SAG. Right now we're under the radar, so it is what it is. Yes?
Gary, had you considered, you were talking about making more games more affordable, had you considered maybe go from rather a point-to-point wiring design, maybe like a full play field, you know, socket-based or different?
The problem with a full play field socket-based system, in other words, the big play field things, is it's more expensive significantly than the wiring. For China, we did it in small quantity, and the small quantity cost, we used LEDs, which are cheaper, than these twist-in sockets, which are very expensive, and the routing's very expensive. But the size, the amount of square inches of material you're paying for, it was $450 a game, quantity of only 50, but $450 a game. So there are answers like that. If you remember, we used to do small light boards. We went away from that because that was more expensive than doing real cables. But there's another electronics answer, which is more modern than a matrix system with all the wires out there, which I'm not going to talk about right now, but those of you who know electronics would guess what I'm talking about right away. Think about how a car is wired. They don't have a huge big cable. They're just sending out a signal.
I'm just an occasional homeowner who buys private sector stuff.
I'm sorry.
Just like a homeowner, you know, I want to buy, just, you know, I don't want to buy from the distributor. You talked about a couple of years ago buying brick from you.
You know, maybe at some point we would sell direct. Parts would be very nice to sell direct, but not at a price. You know, changing a distribution network. We have a very set distribution network in Europe, or an export. It works very well. And our distributors in Europe, Peter, now you leave. You should have stayed to hear this. Our distributors in Europe are really importers, and they're stocking distributors. Here, the distribution network has got some problems to it. And we're adding some customers, and sometimes we end up creating a pile of poo-poo in a market and more trouble than it made sense to do. We're feeling our way through. To make a massive change, like we do sell the classic Iron Man direct, but to make a massive change to lots of direct sales is a big, dangerous change. You have to think this through and do it very carefully. Will we do that? Maybe. But will you save much money? We would have a cost involved with doing that. You know, some of these guys are selling you at way too cheap a price and making way too little. So sometimes you're better off buying from them because I'm going to have to mark it up so that the reseller can also make money competing against me. So it's a very good thought. We consider it. We sell T-shirts direct. We want to sell parts direct. We sell Iron Man Classic direct. What do we do overall? These are difficult questions in the structure of a business and its sales and distribution being considered. Somebody, anybody, go. Yes, ma'am. About half and half, about half overseas. It's historic that way. And the nice thing about overseas is we have a few small customers that take, you know, for Hong Kong two games, but generally, you know, France is going to buy 69 games, a container, $300,000-$400,000, boom, cash in advance. Italy's going to buy, it's cash flow. It runs the business. That's what carries the business. Without export sales, you know, again, you know, we've got a couple hundred people to pay every week in order to make games. You know, some on our payroll, some are, you know, on somebody else's payroll, leased employees, consultants, what have you. But we've got, you know, people to pay every week, so we need to keep this thing moving. We're not in the position where we can sit back and say, okay, let's take our time, let's get this game done, and then we'll go decide how we're going to make it. And who's going to buy all these 3,500 pieces of parts and all that? We've got a buyer there. He has to be paid every week, you know, or buyers and so forth. So about half of it, and it's very, very important. Next was...
You're saying that you've got your production costs and development costs and so forth. What establishes your total production run volume?
What establishes our production run?
Yeah, how do you set your limit or your total run size? Is it very...
What we can sell. What we can sell. Basically, you know, what you do in games, you release, you don't, listen, we used to release 1,000 games. Forget it. We ain't releasing 1,000 games. That's too many to release at once. First of all, If you look at our first games, when we first went into business, we had to stop and restart. Those of you who remember Secret Service would know that it didn't work. And luckily we have, you know, great technical people, service people, but it didn't work. You have to start out, you know, reasonably. We typically order 250 sets of parts, because we want to be sure, yeah, we've made a sample or so off of prototype parts. We want to see the production parts. I don't mind having 250, you know, and maybe this one's no good, so I got to buy more. But if I buy 1,000 of everything, first of all, I've assumed the market is 1,000, which I got to tell you is a lot of games right now. And second, I may have 1,000 bad pieces. So I'm going to release 250, we're going to release 250, then 500, then 250, you know, and generally, you know, and as far as the premiums, we're going to pick a number. We pick 350 for Rolling Stones based on Rolling Stones collectors and pinball collectors and what we thought we would do, and based on the fact that 250 Avatar went out very quickly. I would say 350 is probably the right number, maybe a little bit aggressive, but we're making 250 of them now and 100 later, you know, when we think we're ready, when the market's ready for the other 100, and there will be 350. We did the first premium type game. We did it on Elvis Gold with Steve, and I did that, it was at the beginning of the run. We would like to get to the point where all our premiums are at the beginning of the run, and we aim towards doing that, but we're not there yet. We did 500 of that one, but the market was significantly different at that time, much bigger. We did 500, as I remember, 500 Spider-Man Black. Now, these were both eye candy, nothing different in the game. The 500 Spider-Man Black took us about 2 years to get through. Market was much better. We're doing okay. At 350 is the right number for Rolling Stones. Any more than that, we would devalue it. If we made 500, it's too many. If we made 750 of the premium, too many, they wouldn't be worth anything. And we have to get more money from them because we're putting more money in them.
Okay, so you're basing it on market?
We're basing it on market and incremental releases. It, with the exception of the premium, we have to pick a number.
Yeah, I got a question. There's a local operator who has a machine in a bar. And it's going to trash. He doesn't want, you know, to give it up. But the thing is, you try to talk to him, and he just doesn't care about it. Would there be anything about, you know, going to the, you know, you or somebody and saying, look, this operator is not taking care of machines? What if that's the one person's only experience? They're going to be turned off.
Absolutely. You know what? I'd call them for you, but I don't know what it would do. I mean, certainly the real plus is the location owner. Talk to him and say, you know, we're not coming. Go ahead.
Pinball Police Patrol.
is that an auxiliary of the fashion police? Never mind.
But if you have something, you know, where you find out who's distributing to them, then look.
Tell me after this. Get me information. I'll give you my email, and I'll give it a shot. I'll give it a shot. You can't fall off the floor, so that's an old expression. Yes, ma'am. You see, the pretty lady gets called on. I'm sorry. The white hair is good, but the pretty lady is better. Okay. First thing I'm going to say to you is that I'm going to take Steve's position and say, well, I don't know the exact percentage, you know, 50-50, that kind of thing. I don't know how to answer that other than to say we want the game to be fun in any event, in all events, for everybody. And certainly the collector game maybe needs more in it because you guys are often going to be the buyer. Although in the case of Rolling Stones, you know, you're going to have, I mean, there are people that have £1 million sterling of Rolling Stones goodies or whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, there's some collectors who aren't pinball people. The theme, the title, you know, somebody asked Steve about licensed titles. And You know, and again, it's like real estate, it's title, title, title. I am the big believer in licensed titles. You know, if we make a stuffed animal that looks like a mouse, we can't sell it unless we pay Walt, and then we can sell all that we make. In Star Wars, the original Star Wars, Lucas went to see Ladd, who was the head of the studio, and they owed him some money from the first movie, and Lucas said, I'll tell you what, just give me all the ancillary rights, don't pay me. Give me all the licensing rights. Ladd calls and says, well, you know, what does this really mean? He asked his staff, okay, you can have all the ancillary rights, which is over $1 billion, it turned out to be. He created licensing. If I call my French customer and I say, I've got, somebody mentioned Zombie, I've got Zombie, they say, good, send me two, I'll test it. If I say, I got Rolling Stone, send me 69 and here's $400,000. It keeps it moving, it starts it moving. Then it puts the designer, it gives him four corners within which to design. We did a game called Tales from the Crypt, and there was a I'm going to tip it over. I get excited. We did a game, Tales from the Crypt, and there was a scene in the Dot Matrix, very cool, somebody's being cut in half with a chainsaw. Our guys were very creative, except not there. That was Joe Pesci. I saw the episode. You know, it gives guys ideas. It puts them in touch. You know, Arnold did all the speech on Terminator 2, 3, whichever it was. What did we do? 3, yeah. Arnold did all the speech on that. On Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane gave us an hour of speech. The guy's in an hour. He can, you know, he can read the whole phone book. The guy's great. Other creative people telling us what to put in the game, what's appropriate for the title, out of our pinball ivory tower into the real world. Remember, we're not making games for ourselves or just for you. We need, all game design is trying to do the same thing, whether it's slot machines or Wii games or whatever it might be. Broaden the player base and keep most of the core interested. If we don't broaden the player base, then the core goes away. You know, we made the games harder because the players got better. So then we made it harder, and the players got better. We made it harder. These guys got married, stayed home, maybe wanted a game at home, maybe not, didn't go to the bar. And the new players played this, and they got that 45 seconds I was talking about and said, that's it. I'm not interested in pinball. And we killed ourselves. Larry DeMar's neighbor wrote an article from talking to Larry, as Steve says, the greatest, one of the greatest of pinball rules guys. He said the solid state, the computer that's in the game, killed us because it let us make the game so complicated. You know, that I've got that article somewhere. And you know, we got so involved in the intricacies and we forgot fun. The ball is wild. Harry Williams. Back there first.
R&D question. With increasing advanced technology and segmentation of the market, you know, pinball is sort of the evolutionary link between, you know, horseshoes and Grand Theft Auto. I mean, it's an
analog. Woo, okay. Wait a minute, I gotta write that one down. Okay.
How close, you know, can we get to that line? Have you been experimenting with more in that direction?
We have not experimented with the Pinball 2000 type of thing. Pinball 2000 was a great engineering effort. Some of you might love it. It, as an economic project, was just way too costly. There were some misconceptions like converting playfields, because the economics don't make sense to convert a playfield. Better to sell the game to you and buy a new game than to buy a new playfield and have an old playfield sitting there. By the way, I proved pinball machines conversion doesn't work, because when he did high speed, I did Pinstar's Gamatron, which was Flight 2000 narrow body, and his high speed showed that there was no reason to buy a conversion kit for a pinball machine. So he killed me then too. But that particular concept had some real problems to it that, from a marketing point of view and a cost point of view, were apparent, but you got to give them the Castro's credit. They put through lots of money. They let the guys just go fly. They didn't give them any direction. And this was in September of 99 when we bought our company from Sega. And I said to Sega, Williams is getting out of the pinball business, because I was reading the 10-Ks, the SEC documents. And it was clear that they needed 20,000 machines a year to break even, and the market was spit compared to that. So I knew that it wasn't going to work, and I talked to the guys. I also knew that that game takes two cars to move. And in France, you move a pinball machine in the back of a hatchback. And the first guy who came to pick one up came to the distributor in his car and said, I only brought one car. How do I get that big monitor to the location? So, I mean, there's all kinds of things that you have to understand the business that you're in to do. But it was a great engineering effort, and it's really cool. It's very cool what they did. Way in the back.
Yeah, you mentioned that the operators are most important to you.
No. I need all three legs. All three legs of that farmer's stool.
You need all three legs, but you mentioned how important the operator.
Absolutely.
At the same time, you create the pinball machine, Wheel of Fortune, that y'all kind of abandoned the software midway through. It's definitely an unfinished game. I'm coming back on. I'm wondering if there's any chance that the software ever gets.
You know, that was the question of 2 years ago, and I haven't done anything with it since then. There's a big pile of sand here. I hope you guys can see it. And I'm going to go bury my head in that pile of sand right now, because I don't have an answer for you. Wheel of Fortune had a number of mistakes in it. One was it tried to do too much. The other is, as I remember, it was not an Italian bottom, and sort of a funny bottom on that game. Is it Wheel of Fortune? Yeah? Huh?
I like the bottom of the game.
Yeah, but for the general market, what did Steve, if you heard Steve speak, that's, you know, that he doesn't mess with. And as my French customer Armand said to me, he saw the game and he said, very simply, Gary, you know better. Armand, you know Armand.
The operator operates the games, and we understand that you're in the business of selling new games, not used games, but a giant portion of an operator's expenses for the initial game to sell later.
I understand what you're saying, but he's not making money in the cash box like he needs to. I know some of those fine, some of the others not fine. The operator has a resale value. He gets the best return on investment. But the operator doesn't really consider that when he buys his game. He knows it. In the back of his mind, he knows it. But the operator is really concerned with cash in the cash can. What's in the game today, and what am I going to have to pay to keep it running? When he sells it, great. He gets a residual. That's my sales pitch. Forget it. It's not the right sales pitch, because that operator needs cash today, not when he sells the game. He needs, and most of them are, you know, not the biggest businesses. He needs cash today to buy his Touch Tunes or whatever it might be. He needs cash today. So, you know, I sit there and I tell them, you should all be operating Family Guy, but you guys are in the equipment business and not smart enough to know that to be in the entertainment business. And no, I mean, I got in such trouble with some of these guys in my soapbox. The fact of the matter is, he needs a game that people will play and make more money on. He needs, you know, if he's making 80, 100 bucks a week on a pinball machine, he needs that to get up, because he's got 80 or 100, half of which the bar's keeping, and at 40 bucks a week, his end, before service, it's way too thin. So you forget the resale value. It's what he's getting now. We got to get his earnings up. And if the games are playing for 45 minutes, he can't make any money. So, yeah, it may have a little better resale value. Who cares? They all have a decent resale value. And one's a little more than the other. What's in the cash can? That's what counts. Yes, I'll come back to you in a minute. Yeah.
I'm a big Rolling Stones fan as well. Just curious if you had any interesting stories about working with the Rolling Stones organization too.
I can tell you that most of I did not meet Mick Jagger. Most of the stuff went to Mick Jagger. We did have a little concern that with Mick out front, that somebody else would say that. I mean, Keith and Mick, there's a book about them. They'll each count and see whose pictures are in, how many times one better not be in more than the other. But I did not deal with them directly. I dealt with their licensing agent who did the, by the way, the speech on the game is done by Tom Bennett, who is their is the head of Bravado, their licensing group. He did a great job, I think. He is English. Excuse me. Hello. Yeah, everything okay? Okay, good. Then I'll call you later. I'm giving my speech right now, honey. Bye. When I was speaking, and he'll tell you, when I was speaking at the European Pinball Championship, Joe Camico called me in the middle of the speech. So I should turn the phone off, but somebody's getting on a plane. I want to be sure they got on the plane. I hope I answered your question, but you know, it's always interesting. Each one is a little different. You are next, I think. Then I'll get you.
If you read the Wall Street Journal often, you see that a lot of businesses, including high tax states like California, New Jersey, get high tax states like Texas. Have you ever considered moving your operation to a more business tax friendly state?
No. And I'll tell you why, but I will tell you that when our state income tax went up, my partner was ready to move himself. It just got crazy. The reason I say no is that, yes, we're established where we are. Yes, people are where we are. The workers are where we are. More important, the people with the tooling, the little plastic posts foremost are where we are. The people who work there who design games or engineer games. Our staff lives locally. We're not going to get them all to move. And it's really, you can talk about the two things you want to do is you want your factory and your design staff in the same place in pinball. You don't want to build in China and design in Chicago, build in Mexico and design in Chicago, build anywhere, build in Texas and design in Chicago. Build anywhere, design in Chicago and build anywhere else is crazy, absolutely crazy. And Steve, talked about how hard it was for him. He ended up 7 months in our factory a year because he was in California. It's difficult. You want it all centralized, and Chicago is the pinball capital. When we started as Data East Pinball, we had the bottom arch had a screen art in the middle with a picture, a map of the U.S. and a flag, DE, Data East, coming out of Chicago. And being a Japanese company, we wanted them to know we were Chicago. Manufactured in Chicago, Illinois, the pinball capital of the world. Of course, like Japanese, we misspelled capital and didn't know that till halfway through the next game. We did. We misspelled it.
The
Rolling Stones.
More timeless, like the Rolling Stones.
Okay. First of all, there are two more Avatar movies to come out, so I don't think it'll be forgotten too quickly. We do think about some longevity there. We do very, very well with comic book superhero movies, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Batman. We like those a lot, and they have great longevity. So we do well with those. We've picked some titles that aren't so great, but we're not doing that anymore. We did some out of expediency a few years ago. In the back over there.
Yeah,
You. Yep, yep. You're back enough. That's, to me, that's a back. My eyesight's not that good. You're far away. I'm 65.
I'm curious about the design and development process. How much of it is computer simulation, and how much of it is cut, fit, and dry?
Yes. Actually, the technology has changed quite a bit. I mean, Steve's going to use CAD and draw his play field and figure out some stuff on it, which is two-dimensional, instead of a big drafting board and T-squares and electric erasers and what have you. Some of the mechanical parts are designed in a 3D design, SolidWorks, thank you. Whew. SolidWorks, Joe Quadri, SolidWorks, we got them all, or whoever the other guy was. And SolidWorks so that they can operate them right on it. So that does, there's still trial and error. It still doesn't necessarily work, but it gets you closer to start with, they tell me.
We're also using finite element analysis to make sure that parts are durable and developed in such a way that they'll be strong. And
okay, did you hear what he said? Yeah, okay. Thanks for telling me. I didn't know that. I'm sorry. Who's that? Go ahead.
What's the development cycle look like as far as duration?
9 months to a year. But, you know, when I say that, there's an overlap. For example, playfield guy and the software rules guy, he's more than a programmer. He's a rules designer. He's part of the design, led by the playfield guy, but he's part of the design. And they're going to collaborate in the beginning. And then Steve's going to go off and do his work while Lyman's working on something else. And then they'll come back. And ultimately, Steve may start another game before Lyman's done, you know, and so forth. So there's an overlap. You know, the art stuff and so forth is all going on. It's just a big overlap. It's not like we can say this team designs one game every 13 months like his great opportunity, you know, just as different. Yeah.
You know, ultimately, we thought that was going to be the game of the future. What do you think happened?
Altercade. The video?
Yeah.
Altercade had a lot of other games on it, right? And it's very similar to Arcade Legends that Chicago Gaming, which is Churchill Cabinet, our cabinet manufacturer makes, and as a matter of fact, is they used to work together. Altercade. Ultrapin. Oh, which, the video one? Real simple. It's not a pinball machine. There's no ball on it. The ball is not wild. Video pinball never has, never will work. The best one I've ever seen, the best video pinball I ever saw was IT's, which his brother designed. It was designed by a pinball guy. But they realized it wasn't going anywhere. It was no good. IT did incredible technologies. It's just a non-starter. You wonder why people put money into that kind of thing. I mean, you know, you want to do that, give me the money. I can use it.
How many would produce among people?
I have no idea. I have no idea. Not many. I have no idea. Who's, yep.
Do you think it's ever possible to develop or make something like Baby Pac-Man again, where it's kind of like half video game?
I don't. You know, where you get to play a lousy pinball machine, and if you do well, you get to play a lousy video game. Okay? No, I don't. I don't. Ill-conceived. Listen, it's a pinball machine. The ball is wild, Harry said. It's a pinball machine. You know, it's not a gambling device. It's not a video game. It's a pinball machine. We make, Steve designs, we make pinball machines. Anybody, go. You guys fight with each other.
As the biggest problem that I see with pinball and the reason for it dying is a couple of things. One is it takes a lot of real estate to park.
Absolutely correct.
Doesn't want to commit that real estate. Two, like you said, it takes too long to play for some cases, and you're not getting kind of turnaround and return. Have you thought about integrating other technologies, such as wireless technologies that will continue keeping track of the player's score from machine to machine to location?
Yes.
Platform independence, where that same machine is available through the actual pinball machine itself, the mechanical device, which everyone loves to play, as well as internet and iPhone-type apps. So you can play it anywhere you want, and that builds an excitement.
We have, and we've just started. You know, there's so much technology, so many changes, and you know, we know, you know, there's more social networking of, you know, which would include, you know, reporting scores and this or that. There's a lot that can be done. We thought about it. You know, everything takes longer than one wants. First, we have to clean our pinball house, and then we see what we do next. But let me point out, you're right about the size of the game. And that has, we've lost cafes to, we've lost a lot of cafes to no smoking laws, French cafes to no smoking laws, to better enforcement of drinking laws, lower alcohol content. You know, all that is good stuff, but it hurts our coin-op business. We've lost games to other entertainments. You know, when we, in the heyday of pinball in the early 90s, what was there? You know, video had become a little boring. Pinball was great. There was no internet yet. There was none of these things that the kids play. You know, Lyman says, well, when he used to go pick up his pizza in college, he'd play the video game or the pinball machine. Now the kids go there, and, you know, they're playing games on this while they're waiting. We have a lot of other competition. We're not going back to 100,000 machines a year. Yet, if we give up completely coin-op, we're not going anywhere. We're going out of business.
Build that excitement by going.
We have to get there. But that's, again, we've got to get the operator to make money with the game and give him more to make even more money. But if we lose the operator, there's no point working on any of that.
With web enablement and reporting from the machine back to you, you can provide incentive.
Yeah, yes. Yep, absolutely. Now, remember, there's a cost associated both in us developing and maintaining a server, but also now you're adding to each game. Wi-Fi. You know, one of the things that I wanted that I didn't succeed with because we were going through too much turmoil and it was too much work, but we did Big Buck Hunter for a number of reasons. One is it's a very popular video game in America. We wanted some video people to try pinball. We wanted some video operators to try pinball. We wanted to be involved with other creative people, which would be Eugene Jarvis, George Petro, and Mark Ritchie, all of whom participated in the design of this game. We wanted to plug our pinball machine in. We never got there because it needs work and electronics. We wanted to plug our pinball machine into their Big Buck Hunter video game in a bar when the video game was online and use their server, not our server, because I didn't have the wherewithal to do it. Didn't happen, but that was the thought. You know, when Williams came out with Pinball 2000, you know, that was smoke and mirrors, I believed. So we had to have our smoke and mirrors. And what we had was we told everybody, and we worked with IT, we were going to put our pinball machine in their tournament system. Few problems basically somebody, you know, if you're giving away money, you take the operator takes the glass off and plays with his hands, you know, and so we had some things to beat it that were really far-fetched, but we were on a 6800, and when they went off a modem onto faster lines and all that, our 6800 microprocessor was left behind. Somebody who has, you had one over there, yeah.
I'm curious about the Bash Gary feature on Lord of the Rings. Was that authorized or programmed before or after you saw it?
The which feature?
Bash Gary. Do you know that?
You'll have to excuse me. I'm going to go find a Lord of the Rings downstairs and. Wait a minute. Thank you. Good question. Go ahead.
I got a question with regards to some of the classics that you're talking about. Do you have, like, on your website a way of people signing up for, like, a monthly newsletter or something that would let them know when you're coming out with the classics?
We have to do a newsletter more regularly. I need a newsletter to my distributor customers in Europe, for example, to tell them. We sell our shirts online, and all of a sudden one of my customers says, my customers tell me you're doing such and such. Oh, yeah, you're right. So often I email them stuff, but we need more newsletter stuff. We need more correspondence. Jody came on a little while ago. We need to do a lot more with it. So We need that. We need a lot more communication, not just press releases and what have you, but a lot more communication. You know, we have a Facebook page and all that. That's all. We didn't have any of that before. It's all changing. Our original Facebook page was set up by my daughter, Lindsay, unauthorized, and the reason she set it up was so that all her friends could vote that we should do Lost as a title. Unfortunately, the show was going off the air, so it was too late by the time we would have done the game. Jody has partially taken over control of it, although all the reports, he hasn't figured out how to get to come to him. They still go to my daughter, who I've begged now because she says, well, he took it over. Why should I be sending him those reports, you know? Lindsay, send him the reports, please. I could do that, you know. Okay, whatever. Just send him the reports. We had that discussion the other day at dinner. She was mad because I lost a T-shirt of hers in my house, so whatever. Long story. Next, anybody else? Have I worn you out yet? Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I want to ask you, okay, who was the one with the brains to get the thing for Avatar?
To get what for Avatar? To get the title? I don't know. I do most of the licensing in the negotiation, but we all talk about designers and Jody in marketing and Dave and myself and the salespeople, what we might want to do. We listen, you know, we read a lot and so forth. Avatar, this is interesting. I will tell you this. Avatar we did after the movie. Typically, you want to do a title before the movie. You'll notice we very rarely do first-run movies. We do the sequel. Because if we do a first-run movie before it comes out, A, it could be bad, like Last Action Hero, the movie. B is we don't have any source material, any assets. We don't have any film to digitize or speech or scripts or anything. It's just you can't do it unless you do the second movie and include the first and the second. Yes, sir? Pardon? I said about nine months to a year, but again, there's a lot of overlap. Yeah, that's okay. I'll answer the next time, too. Next meeting, next show, whatever. Yes, sir?
Is there any way, for me personally as a collector, I've got data use the Simpsons. Is there any way that the spare parts market is drying up for plastics? Is there any way you can do a small amount of plastics?
If we had enough business to it, you know, we're more attuned to the operator business, I have to say, and we have to consider this. We have typically a 7-year cycle on which we're allowed to do the replacement parts. Maybe we're going to have to start taking a longer cycle. I increased from 5 to 7, but remember, we were doing coin-op games, and 7 years seemed adequate. You know, I could probably get some permission to do something like that. I have to see. The problem is the cost is going to be very expensive because you only want the right slingshot or something. But I got to make the whole sheet, okay? So I'm going to charge you for the whole sheet, and I'm only going to make 20 of them. And now you're going to say, you're ripping me off. Well, I'm not, but it's expensive. So we have to figure out what to do. Now, some of the guys downstairs are better suited for that kind of production than I am.
But if it's a licensed theme, they can't go do that. It's going to probably have to come
through. If it's a licensed theme, they can't legally do that.
Listen to his words.
Anybody else? One more. I think we're probably...
The whole sheet, everyone had an issue with replacing.
Pardon me?
If you had to reprint the whole sheet, yeah. I wouldn't have any issue with
plastic. Okay, well, you know, I take that under advisement, as we say. It's, you know, it's the fact is the prices get just screwy, and that's where the problem is. Which is why sometimes other people are better at that kind of thing. I mean, we're a pinball factory, you know, not a parts house. You know, some of these guys downstairs do a better job with parts than we're going to do because they're into parts. You know, we're into pinball machines. We want to service our games for you and for the operator. We don't want the parts to be too expensive for the operator, especially because then the economics of operating don't work. But we are, you know, again, every day. That door is going to open, and 100, 200 people are going to come in that building, and at the end of the week, they're going to be paid. So, you know, we have to look at this whole process, parts, service, design, manufacturing, the MRP, the buyer, and all that. And pinball manufacturer is not for the faint of heart if you really have ever manufactured a pinball machine. And, you know, I mean, Steve has, I have, there's probably nobody else in this building that has, and it's not easy. Yes, sir, in the back.
Speaking of operators, a lot of operators I've talked to have always, you know, one main reason they don't like pinball is because they have to maintain the flipper dust, the rubber brand. You know, besides an LED, do you see any simple changes, maybe, you know?
Yes.
The rubber difference.
Actually, we made the rubbers. We made the rubbers worse. We did. But I'm going to tell you this. We used to have white rubbers, which were a softer durometer, more bouncy, more randomness. We went to the black rubbers for two reasons. We made them harder so they wouldn't wear out as much, and the black doesn't get dirty like the white ones. We've now changed in many places to a soft durometer black rubber because the ball, that randomness that I'm talking about, half random, half skill, we need that randomness in pinball. Pat Lawler always designed his games, he said, white rubbers. Steve was more malleable. He would listen to me and use the black rubbers. Oh, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was wrong.
A game that works can make money. A game with broken white rubbers.
That's right. Now, you know, it's hard to say which is right. So we use some of the softer and some of the harder. So part of it is the rubbers aren't getting any better in that respect. If the game makes money, if the game would make money, then he'll change the rubbers or turn them. If the light bulbs don't burn out, you know, he'll see that. He'll see a broken rubber. He'll see it. Somebody will tell him the light bulb out. There's no reason in today's world to have light bulbs burning out. It's just stupid. Yes, sir.
One problem with that is sometimes it's kind of a catch-22 because sometimes the game isn't making money because
absolutely.
That flipper doesn't work.
Yeah.
So we put their money in, it's like, oh.
Yeah, I know, absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. Back there, yes?
Are there any plans in the future to move away from dot matrix to some newer display technology that's just not financially feasible?
We are talking about what to do in the I don't have an answer for you. We are talking about what to do. There's no plans, but there's discussions. We're talking about what to do on the different levels of game. You know, right now we have a dot matrix on everything. Certainly if we do an ELG, it goes the other way. It should be a numeric or an alphanumeric. You don't need all of that on a cheap game, a much cheaper game. On the premium, maybe you need something else. You know, we're got to look at cost, got to look at what we're doing. A lot of things to study yet. Ultimately, will the dot matrix always be available? I don't know. Right now, for Europe, we have to use an LED dot matrix instead of the gas discharge. Costs us a little more money, but that's because of the Rojas requirements of you can't have that gas and the lead, no lead, there's a lead seal on it, that type of thing. It's a little bit different. That doesn't line up quite as well, but it is what it is. Yes, sir.
Following up on the question from this side of the room on spare parts and licensing, and bearing in mind the three-legged stool philosophy, do you think it would be practical, from your perspective, when you license a game, to get transferable spare part license?
Okay, first of all, it would be... No, it wouldn't be practical, but it'd be good to get a longer one. The reason it's not practical is that no licensor is going to give their IP to a total stranger. I cannot transfer my Rolling Stones license to, if there were another manufacturer, to another manufacturer to make it. It's personal to our company. They depend on us. They trust us. I can't give it to some stranger who's going to then go do what God knows what with it. So it's a good question, but no. They're very protective of it. And again, you know, I'm a licensee. I like licensing. That it, everybody? Have I done it all? One more.
With the Rolling Stones, you know, really exciting license people talk about before. It seems to me, you know, I know pinball in general is not as mainstream as it used to be, but you know, I would think that there'd be a lot of people that probably at least 10,000 units just kind of selling into the consumer market. You know, doctors, lawyers, Maxim magazine.
You know, the question is how to, you know, 10,000 is an enormous number. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, we haven't had anything like that in a lifetime. I mean, I'd love to have 10,000 games a year, all titles. You know, we're playing four new titles and some remakes and this or that and different segments, you know, made for different segments. It's a huge number. One of the reasons we want an ELG and to get into the Amazon.coms and things like entry-level game Amazon.coms and all that, is that we need, there is a large doctor, lawyer, candlestick maker market that we don't have the channel to get to. You know, you can talk to all of the sellers downstairs and to all of the game distributors and billiard dealers. Ain't gonna happen. We don't have the right distribution network. If we can get something that will get us into big box stores and .coms, then we've got a retail product. If we can get into, you know, the obvious electronic big box stores that you would want to be in.
You know, the only thing is, I only knew that it was coming out because of in the pinball. But when I told a lot of people that I knew who were Rolling Stones fans that this thing was coming out, they said, what?
And we'd like to do more with the Rolling Stones, which that doesn't mean they'll necessarily let us. We're trying to do that. It seems easy. It just seems easy. It seems so easy. It's frustrating. It seems so easy. It should be. It's not. It's really not. And even if they knew, you know, even, you know, and we've had plenty of articles about our company since we have this PR agency doing it. You know, every airplane I'm on recently seems to have an article about our company in their in-flight magazine. I mean, you know, it's just, we're everywhere. You know? I mean, everywhere you step into us. It's just not that easy. We need the network, the people with the cash to finance and buy and so forth. It's just a lot more business than we're back in a mom-pa storefrontish type business, and we need to get back out of the storefront to get that big ELG entry-level game push into it. And that will interest people in pinball, and then we come back alive. We need that, and we need to be, for that to happen, they need to see it in the street. Yes, sir?
With the operators and people not carrying cash these days, is that an issue with...
Not carrying what?
Not carrying cash. Is that a...
Operators not carrying cash.
No, people going to operators to play these games, the fact that people don't carry cash.
There's cash in, you know, bars and what have you. But in many arcades, or you go to a, like we're in GameWorks. They do a big job in GameWorks in Schaumburg with the tournaments and with our premiere parties and what have you. They're all on swipe cards. The big thing in the coin op industry today is Sokoa out of Argentina, is LAI out of Australia, Texas here. Their office is here in Dallas. Is, you know, these different swipe card systems that keep track of everything and change. Chucky's quarters. Chucky's straight quarter. There's straight quarter play. But, you know, there's just a lot of that going on. As far as, you know, one day you're going to buy your Coca-Cola with your cell phone. You know, you're going to go up to the machine and you're going to buy your Coca-Cola with it. Cash will be, you know, gone.
Can we play our pinball?
One day. But you can get a cell phone app for pinball, I'm told. Yes and yes, and then that's...
Well, following up on what he's saying, have you considered maybe adding, like, something where you can put, like, a debit card?
Yes, we have. We want to do that, but we can't do everything, right? You know, you know, you got to stay focused and get a few projects done. You know, people want to do everything for everybody. You can't. And we may be too early, because if you look at, you know, putting the debit card in and doing it with a pinball machine, and a lot of our guys, you know, think, oh, you know, Jody or whatever, this is the thing to do. It's a great thing to do when the video game next to us is doing it. Again, I wanted to tie up to the big buck hunter. We want to get the pinball in the location, and if we think that we're going to lead the industry, the coin-op industry, with a pinball machine in a bar, I want that pot. It's better than anything I've ever had. It's better than my vodka. So, I mean, you know, it, you know, we have to realize where the heck we are, what we are. Yes, sir?
Churchill Cabinets, you mentioned them, they have a way they can upgrade their video games to add more games. In your three-legged stool concept, is it possible to make the homeowner server version? If they really like it, give the option to go, you can upgrade your pro model for another $800 or whatever it is, and they still might make some money that way. They might go into a little bit more serious to get pinball
play. The ELG, it's blocked, I don't know who it is. The ELG, and I don't know how to make it shut. Oh, yes, I do. I don't know how to work this thing. This is my ex-wife's phone. I don't even know. I don't even know how it works. It's my SIM card in it, but it's her phone. She got a new one. I never get a new phone. I get everybody's old phone. I'm cheap. When we do the ELG type game, it's going to be significantly different, and it'll be a different title. It'll be its own title. We are using the same title right now for the pro and the premium because there's not enough business in either one of those to make it just for one. Yeah, sometimes we'll have only a pro, not a premium, but there's not enough business. You can't say I'm only going to build 350 of a premium, which is probably what the market will bear at a higher price, and then say I'm going to cover all my costs in that premium game. The additions from a pro to a premium would be require a new playfield because there's more mechanical devices on it. So that's difficult to do. It's, you know, again, I proved the conversion pinball, or Steve proved the conversion pinball, or made me prove the conversion pinball doesn't work. If you've got a pro and you want a premium, you're going to trade it in. And that's the way it works. Now, we're going to try and have the premiums. We're going to get to a point like we were once before of getting the premium being at the beginning and hopefully running out so everybody's stuck with buying a pro because they didn't jump on the premium soon enough. But any event, you know, to try and do that. The business is, you know, the volumes are significantly different. The business has changed from what it was when Steve did Elvis and we did our first 500-watt limited edition run. That it, folks? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.